it's high on a mountain, the warm winds are blowing, and where the winds are blowing to, there ain't no way of knowing. The mountain grass is short, it's dry and close to burning, crying out for water as the season's turning. Sweet smell of the pines, tall western cedar, drifting on the wind through the mountains like a river.
Hello, my name is Ayana Young, and I welcome you to Unlearn and Rewild, where we explore radical ideas relating to earth renewal. Today, we are excited to have Toby Hemenway on. Toby Hemenway is the author of Gaia's Garden, a guide to home-scale permaculture, which was awarded the Nautilus Gold Medal in 2011, and for the last 8 years has been the best-selling permaculture book in the world. Toby has been an adjunct professor at Portland State University, scholar-in-residence at Pacific University, and has taught over 60 72-hour permaculture design courses. He has presented at conferences such as Bioneers, Soulfest, and EcoFarm, and many universities and educational venues. After obtaining a degree in biology from Tufts University, Toby worked for many years as a researcher in genetics and immunology. He was the editor of Permaculture Activist, a journal of ecological design and sustainable culture, from 1999 to 2004. He moved to Portland, Oregon in 2004 and spent 6 years developing urban sustainability resources there. Hello, Toby. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Ayana. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's exciting to explore the themes of this show with a rare bird such as yourself, who is equal parts abstract and practical, idealist and realist, who can zoom all the way out to the prehistoric origins of humanity and problems of civilization, and also zoom in to the specifics of building a functional garden oasis that supports not just gardener, but all the non-human residents. I would like to devote some of the time to both of these areas today. You're perhaps best known for your book, Gaia's Garden, which I cannot recommend more highly. If you haven't read it, buy a copy or borrow one, because you will never look at your place in the world or your own home the same way. Permaculture is a relatively new addition to the English language, and not everyone is well-versed. So would you mind just taking a few moments to give us a nutshell-sized introduction to permaculture and why it's making such a splash?
Sure. Well, just to try and get as small a soundbite definition of permaculture as I can, I guess you could call it ecological design or design based on nature, but that doesn't really tell you very much about it. So a little longer definition that I think of is that if you think of things like organic farming and renewable energy, natural building, and even things like better social justice systems and better decision-making methods, if you think of those as tools for sustainability, then I like to think of permaculture as the toolbox that helps you organize those tools and decide when to use them. Permaculture is not an assemblage of techniques or a technique itself. It's really a decision-making tool for deciding how to use techniques and when to use them and how to make plans for using them. So it's kind of a meta technique, or some people call it a linking discipline that helps connect different fields together. But it's mostly a way of deciding what to do and how to proceed. And I think that's part of why it's becoming very popular these days. It really does seem to be hitting a real swell of activity, in that it offers a lot of solutions by helping us decide what to do. I mean, there's so many techniques out there. There are 50 ways to build soil and 100 ways of making decisions and all different kinds of techniques. And it's really hard to know which one to use in what circumstances. And so permaculture really tries to provide a decision-making protocol to go through to figure out what's the right technique for our conditions. What are our conditions, and how do we choose a good technique for dealing with the problems that our specific situation has? So that's part of why I'm very excited by permaculture, because it does offer this universal toolkit for problem solving.
The word sustainable, I know, is thrown around a lot, and I've heard you speak about sustainable versus regenerative, and I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, the word sustainable is a very good word, and our society is certainly not sustainable at this point, and it would be great to have it be sustainable just in terms of being able to keep doing some of the things that we're doing without depleting the Earth's resources or ruining people's lives or all the other things that happen. But I've really taken a cue here from the architect William McDonough, who talks about sustainability as being kind of a midpoint, because sustainable just means we keep on doing what we're doing, and it doesn't really talk about what we are trying to sustain. And I like to think of sustainability as a midpoint between activities and systems that are degenerative, or that break things down and cause pollution and are degrading the systems that they're in. And then way on the opposite end of the spectrum are regenerative activities that are rebuilding and reconstructing and enhancing and creating more wholeness and more life and just making things better. And so sustainability is right in the middle of those two. It's not necessarily hurting, but it's not necessarily helping either. And I love Bill McDonough's little quip about, if someone came up to you and said, you know, how's your marriage doing? And you answered, well, it's sustainable. that's not really all that great.
And so permaculture is such a fascinating area of study with all these different tools and techniques. And I'm wondering, for people who are searching for a plot of land or a region to begin a permaculture, what are some of the important attributes to be looking for? And what are some deal breakers that should be avoided?
Right. Well, that's a really good question. And I've learned a lot about that, both through making my own mistakes and having some successes, and also from watching other people. And to me, the two critical things on, well, there are three. There are two that have to do with the land and one that have to do with other things. But those are, in particular, the water. Having a good source of water for your land is critical. Without water, nothing else can happen. And permaculture does offer techniques for harvesting water and storing water and all those sorts of things, but it's so much easier if there's already a naturally abundant source of water. And certainly in the western U.S., it's not looking as if water is going to become any more abundant in the future. And I think everywhere in the world, water is a precious resource. Mm-hmm. So water is number one. The second one is soil. Again, it's possible to build really good soil, and I have done it, and I've worked at it. But I've also learned by moving from a place where I built the soil from very poor soil to a place that had really good native soil, that it is so much easier if the soil is already there in good shape. And that's why farmers look for land with good soil. That's their primary concern. And I know not everyone may be farming, but most people do want to grow a little bit of food, and it's so much easier, and growing shade trees and all the other things. And then the third part is community, is finding a place, especially if you're moving anywhere, but moving to the country in particular, is finding a community that will be supportive. Because we moved to a community, to an area where I didn't really think about the community, and actually I knew that it was kind of not necessarily supportive of what we were doing, but I just thought that didn't really matter, that politics and all of that could be transcended. And in general, it was the case. People were very good. It has nothing to do whether they were good people or not, but there was nothing in the community to really get me going. The people's politics and religion and everything else were very, very different from my own. And it was just very hard to get the support and the momentum for what we were trying to do there. So that's the third criteria, is finding communities that will support what you're doing. I think a lot of us have this dream that we'll move out and we'll found our own community, but that's a really difficult thing to do. And just like with soil and with water, it's so much easier if it's already there in existence rather than you have to build it all yourself. So those are the three main things that I would be looking for if I were looking for a piece of land, whether it's in a city or out in the country.
Yeah, that's a really good point about community, because I think that could be potentially overlooked when thinking about having a place to grow food. But just the support system, but also the inspiration and the energy that other people can give to your ideas and vice versa. Going back to the water, peak water is really horrific around the world and many places in the United States, like as you said, the West. So with people that are struggling with peak water, what about dry gardening, or what are some of the ways they can tackle that?
Right. So almost every area gets some rain, and so you just have to make really good use of what rain is there, storing it and catching it. And the other critical leverage point for being able to do dry gardening or really conserving a lot of water is to build your soil. Again, that's the whole idea of finding good soil, is soil that is rich in organic matter is so much more capable of holding water, storing water, than soil that doesn't. So it's a really important leverage point is to build organic matter in your soil. That I've read the statistic that if you can increase the organic matter content of your soil from, say, 1% to 2%, if you can increase it by 1% like that, that increases your soil's ability to hold water to the rate of 16,000 gallons per acre. So in other words, a 1% increase in soil over an acre means that soil will hold 16,000 more gallons of water in it. So it's a huge leverage point of just building up your soil. So that's a really important part of it is by enhancing your soil's ability to hold water. I mean, that's where we use most of our water. So that's where you want it done. Catching water when you can, rainwater catchment tanks or ponds, these sorts of things. And then another piece that's overlooked a lot is reusing water via gray water. Because most water from the laundry and shower really doesn't have significant contaminants in it. A little bit of diluted soap and a little bit of dirt, and all of that actually becomes food for soil organisms. So you can reuse water like that and really have kind of a guilt-free source of irrigation water. So those are some of the techniques for getting more out of the water that you have. And then choosing the right varieties. In most areas, there are traditional crops that were grown by the native people there, or even by old settlers and pioneers that were much less reliant on irrigation. And by finding those old varieties, you can very often find ways of growing plants that may require no irrigation at all, even in pretty dry areas.
Another technique in permaculture that I'm interested in discussing is observation and learning from nature's ways around you. You know, for myself or for others that think about starting a permaculture project, we kind of live in this instant gratification society. So we want to start it now. We want the results. We want to see the fruits of our labor. I'm wondering if you could explain the benefits of observation and what's a reasonable time frame for somebody to expect, maybe not fully developed permaculture or food forest, but something that's starting to produce.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Observation really is at the heart of permaculture. If you look at any list of permaculture methods or permaculture principles, observation is always at the top of the list, because not only is learning to observe or just the simple act of observation really important, you can't mess with something, you can't tinker with something or change it intelligently until you've understood how it works. But also it's really important not to bring our own preconceptions and kind of impose our own ideas on things. And that's something that careful, skillful observation really teaches us, is what's really going on here. We think something is happening, but if we have an open mind and really pay attention, often we'll realize that our own preconceptions or our own first impression isn't really right. So learning to observe with an open mind, not just observe, but do it with an open mind, is really, really important. And I know that most gardeners are told to, the old saying is, wait 1 year. And of course, no one ever does that. We can't. You know, we got to get out and put something in the ground. But you can short circuit that by talking to your neighbors, by looking at the weather reports for past histories, you know, find out what the averages are and the extremes. There's a huge amount of data out there. What's your soil type? What have people grown on the site before? What, just talking to people and looking things up will really save you a lot of time, so that you may not get everything right by jumping right in after doing a little bit of book and neighbor talking observation, but you'll get a lot more right than you would if you just dove in. It is a question of learning from mistakes. Although I do learn from my own mistakes a fair amount, I'd much rather learn from other people's mistakes, and observation is a way of doing that. And then as far as your other question about how long does it take to get things up and running, particularly things like food forests, well, for one thing, we do try and plant things that will give you a fairly quick yield while we're waiting for our chestnut trees to mature in 10 years or whatever. We plant radishes so that in 3 weeks you get a little positive feedback that says you're getting successful. But it seems to take 3 to 5 years or so for the soil to really become fertile enough and mature enough. And also fruit trees and nut trees usually take 3 to 5 years before they're really seriously bearing. So if you're creating a food forest, one of the nice things you can do is while you're waiting for those fruit trees to start to bear, you can put in a lot of annuals in the spaces in between because there'll be plenty of light. Those trees will be small. So while you're waiting for them, you can do other things that will build the soil, enhance habitat, and give you a little bit of food. And then when the fruit trees come on, or the other perennial crops, you won't need as many annuals, and you'll be able to scale them back, and it will all happen naturally. But the wonderful thing about food forests is that they're an eternal learning experience, that in 20 years they'll be changing, and you'll still be learning a lot from them. So they almost never really mature. But like I say, 3 to 5 years, it seems like the mycelial network in the soil gets going and things get mature enough to where suddenly they're able to take off and work almost on their own. You just come in and do pruning and harvesting and cleanup. And by then, all the other processes are making them pretty self-renewing and self-sustaining if they've been designed well.
Wow, well, it definitely puts me in a daydream of having cherry trees and peaches and an abundance of a beautiful food forest around me.
Take me outside, sit in the green garden. Nobody out there, but it's okay now. Bathe in the sunlight. Don't mind if rain falls. Take me outside, sit in the green garden. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. And I'll fly on the wings of a butterfly, high as a treetop, down again. Putting my bag down, taking my shoes off. Walk on the carpet, a green velvet.
To some of the larger scale questions. And I was wondering if you could give us some perspective on how long we have been humans versus how long we have been civilized humans, and what physiological and psychological changes have occurred in this switch to civilized humanity.
Right. Okay. Well, that's obviously a huge topic, but it's one that I love thinking about. And I mean, I think when we talk about human, I mean, there's the physiologically modern human that's about 200,000 years old or so. But the genus Homo, the Greek word for human, arose first about 2 million years ago, the various ancient species of Homo who were not Homo sapiens. So somewhere in between 200,000 and 2 million years ago, I think you could say was when cultures began to arise that we would recognize as human, even if the people then may have, you know, had bigger brows and all the features of so-called primitive humans. They were still doing a lot of the things that we do. I mean, we've been making tools for 2 million years. We've had the controlled use of fire for at least 800,000 years. And there are a lot of things, music and song and art and all of, you know, using plants as medicine. Those are vastly older than civilization. So if you think about the fact that civilization, meaning kind of the domestication of plants and animals, and the cities that were made possible by the abundance created by that, the civilization's really only about 10,000 years old at the oldest. So that the difference is 2 million years or so for being human and 10,000 years for having civilization. And yet we've had culture as human beings for vastly longer than that. So really only a hundredth or 1/200th of human history have we actually had civilization, as opposed to the other 99% of human history where we've been human. We just haven't been living in cities and domesticating things. We've been thinking of nature as the source of our abundance rather than technology and farms and cities and factories as the sources of our abundance. That's the time frame that I like to think of is 1% of human history is civilized, quote unquote, and the other 99% is as much wilder types of humans, but still with very advanced types of cultures.
I am really so interested in your theories on evolution. It enriches this idea of permaculture so much more deeply to see things in that way and to be able to understand that.
Yeah, I think so too. It's been a real eye-opener for me to kind of make these discoveries and really understanding the huge change that we went through when we were domesticated. It's just, wow, do we really want to go that way? What can we retain from this that is useful while we try to rewild ourselves at the same time?
Yeah, and I mean, do you think that considering we've kind of been domesticating ourselves for the last, say, 10,000 years, do you think that's gotten into our genetics?
Yes, I think that we have been changed by it. But the wonderful thing is that living organisms are really flexible. And if we create an environment that fosters wildness, I think a lot of those changes will be undone or they will change to something else. So our genetics has changed a good bit in the last 10,000 years, and I think that means that it can change back or change to something else just as quickly. So we're pretty flexible beings. I think there's one hallmark of a human being. It's how flexible and adaptable we are. So hopefully that'll save us if we can get through this little set of crises that we're facing right now.
Yeah. And do you think it's, especially with the urban permaculture, do you think it's possible to rewild in an urban setting?
I think you have to make a really concerted effort. I think that the whole environment is going against you. But I think you can engage in a lot of the practices of wildness, kind of cultivated interior wildness as well. So I think it's a little more challenging, but I think with some discipline, you can certainly create some wild places within yourself. I'd certainly like to see that. I don't have a lot of good examples, but I'd certainly like to see it.
Your website is patternliteracy.com, and I've heard you use the adjective pattern literate. What is pattern literacy, and how have the patterns of civilization interfered with the patterns of nature?
Right. Well, you can think of literacy in several different forms. I mean, everyone's aware of the word type of literacy, knowing how to read and write. And then people have talked about numeracy, understanding numbers and statistics and at least enough arithmetic so that you can't be confused by numbers and you can't be lied to about statistics easily. And then I also think of pattern literacy is understanding patterns of behavior, patterns of activity, even things like the natural patterns around you. If we start looking at nature, we see all these patterns of branching patterns, spiral patterns, and wave patterns, and ripple patterns. And when we see a pattern in nature, it's really nature's way of solving a design problem. When nature needs to make something light and strong, she has come up on her own with a truss pattern or various other patterns that make things light and strong. So patterns are very often solutions to design problems. And one of the things that we've done as modern human beings, and particularly as industrial human beings, is really to ignore a lot of these patterns in nature and even ignore human behavior patterns and the natural patterns of, say, extended families, a way that human beings have lived for hundreds of thousands of years. We've replaced that with the nuclear family of just, mom and dad or two parents and children. And that's really impoverished family life terrifically, because now instead of having grandparents to take care of the children, you wind up with the parents have to pay to have the children taken care of, and they have to pay to have their parents taken care of. And so we've taken a beautiful system that's full of solutions and broken that pattern to now where we have to put energy and time into taking care of the pieces that we've broken out of it. So the extended family and nuclear family idea is just one natural pattern that we've really destroyed, in particularly in industrial civilization. And there are many, many more examples of that kind of ignoring natural patterns and really imposing a more simplified pattern from outside that we think might work better, but it turns out it very often doesn't.
Mm-hmm. That makes me go on to think about just the ecological damages that we have brought onto the planet from not looking at the patterns. We are by many measures in an endgame ecologically with climate change and industrialization wiping out entire biomes. And it's catching up to us humans with food shortages and droughts. And it feels as if civilization is pulling the rug out from under us and there's no place to escape to. Yet many of us still have this yearning to join the rhythms of nature, live off the land, and celebrate this homecoming, so to speak. How can a permaculture practitioner satisfy her need for a total engagement with her place and community while also fulfilling her need to take a stand strategically at the global level against the destructive forces?
Right. Well, that's a really good question. And one of the things that I've really been noticing is, and also it's a permaculture principle, is simply the effectiveness at really starting at your doorstep. That we think in permaculture of a series of zones, where zone one is the stuff immediately right around you that you deal with every day, zone two are things that you deal with a couple times a week, and so on, going out to outer zones. And although that was originally thought of as a land use or a gardening technique, I also think about my influence on things politically or socially or economically is that there are certain things that I have a huge impact on and that also has a huge impact on me right in my zone one, the things that I do every day, the people that I talk to, the things that I eat, the products that I buy or the food that I eat, all the things that I support every single day. And by paying, I think, the most attention to those, the things that you're really doing every day, you can make the largest impact on your own life through changing those. And I think there's a huge ripple effect. I get very discouraged when I look at the whole global picture, use the word global. And if I think about trying to save the entire planet or the entire country or, you know, some large unit like that, it is terrifically discouraging. Mm-hmm. And one of the paradigms that really is emerging in the last couple decades is the idea of distributed intelligence, that we've really come to understand that top-down planning, that one central agent that dictates all the orders really is not a natural pattern very often, and it doesn't work very well. And so one of the things that permaculturists are advocating and really working with is lots of little centers of activity where it's just individuals who understand permaculture design or permaculture education centers, whatever scale that's on, but many, many small centers of activity. So to me, the idea of saving the planet is not so much going out and working on a global scale, although my hat is off to people who can do that. To me, saving the planet starts with, you know, which one of my neighbors needs help? And very simple little questions like that, you know, where am I getting my food? Is there a local farm that I can support by buying into their CSA or those sorts of things? These really small solutions done in a distributed way by, you know, first tens and then hundreds and then thousands and then millions of people, to me, really are the answer. And, you know, I can't save the whole world. I've kind of given up that project. But there are a couple people that I can save. And my wife has a spiritual teacher who prays every day. He says, send me people I can help. And that, to me, is one of the best things you can look for, is that there are people out there that I can't save. They're not ready, or they don't want it, or they're doing something else. But I know that there are people that I can help. They're ready, and they're out there, and they're somewhere near me. So that's the level that I work on, is really the personal and the local and a little bit of the regional level. And to me, enough of us doing that, and all those little local and community and regional places are all going to hook up to one another and start working really well together. It's my optimistic viewpoint.
Another topic I wanted to touch on that I am really fascinated by that connects with the title of the show, this idea of rewilding and the bigger themes of freedom. You wrote a beautiful piece last year that chronicles your journey leaving Portland and being migratory, like original human inhabitants of this land. And I'd like to quote a bit from your essay entitled The Last Nomads and the Culture of Fear. Quote, "Can a farming civilization ever stop being afraid? Only if it is no longer brainwashed into the belief that domination, labor, and order are what protect it from the caprices of an untrustable nature. Can it ever allow other cultures to exist alongside of it? I'm not sure. I have a vision of farmers living only where farming has proven to be more or less sustainable, in large river valleys like the Nile and Mississippi, while nomads, foragers, and some horticulturalists live in the hills, the smaller valleys, and the delicate lands that agriculture can only destroy. But that would demand that those farmers not fear the freedom of the nomads, and so far, that hasn't happened. I hope we can mature to that point. I wish someday the descendants of Sitting Bull, as well as mine, can ride again across unfenced plains to hunt bison and gather in transient villages along the Little Bighorn and anywhere." Again, that was written by our guest, Toby Hemenway, and you can find the full article on his website, patternliteracy.com. So, Toby, this vision is sweeping in that it allows for farming, horticulture, and nomadism to coexist. My immediate reaction is that the habitat that could support a nomadic culture has been so fragmented and eroded that intensive restoration work must be done first. In your current thinking, what are the major hurdles to this vision, and do we stand a chance of dismantling them in time? And how does permaculture fit into this solution?
Well, I think one of the largest impediments to this is the private ownership of land, the idea that all of these places that people used to be able to migrate across were either held in common or crown land or whatever you wanted to call it. You know, this was one of the things I noticed so acutely on our travels, was that there are fences everywhere. Just everything is carved up, whether they're running cattle or trying to keep people out or just building a fence because they want to have a fence and it's what people do. So that is one of the biggest impediments. One of the things we're blessed with in the United States is a great deal of public land in a bunch of different forms. I've been really interested lately in the ideas of a Yale professor named James Scott, who originally wrote one of his more famous books is called Seeing Like a State, but he has a more recent book and video out called The Art of Not Being Governed. Mm. And in it, he describes the way that the valley cultures were pretty much the state-run, they had governments. And then in the hills, up until very, very recently, whether it's in the so-called hillbillies in Appalachia or the hill tribes in Southeast Asia, the people in the hills really were not governed by these town centers down in the valley. That up until World War II or so, there were quite a few semi-nomadic people in the hills, or travelers, gypsies, people like that, who really were not part of a state. They didn't have a passport. They didn't have an ID. It's been a really recent development where the state has been able to develop enough power to extend up into the hillsides through building roads and helicopters and aircraft. It's been, I think, a product of the fossil fuel age, of just having huge concentrations of energy, mm-hmm. being able to build technologies that could extend the state's reach up into areas where it really couldn't get before very well. And so my hope, again, the optimistic hope, is that as we fall further into the era of energy descent, that the ability to muster these giant concentrations of energy that allow the state to project its power out into the hillsides and far away like that and build superhighways and maintain them up into the mountains and all of that, that as fuel becomes more scarce and expensive, that it will be much more difficult for the state to project that kind of power. So part of me is hoping that this is one of the things that's just going to kind of work itself out, is that the totalitarianism and utter state control of everything will begin to decline as energy resources become less available as well. So that's another impediment, I think, is the simple ability of the state to project its power everywhere because it has access to terrific energy resources now.
Freedom, 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 freedom,
spread your wings, freedom,
freedom, freedom, freedom, freedom, freedom, freedom, freedom, freedom, freedom, freedom,
spread your wings,
fly right now.
Dig into the particulars for a moment. So permaculture is often seen merely as a food production system, but based on the permaculture ethics of earth care, it could be argued that food is just a result of a functioning ecosystem, which we must trust to provide for us. Is there room in this model for any of the structures that we associate with civilization, including cities, car and air travel, a money economy? How could sustenance be shared or sold or otherwise divvied up? And can we tie into this vision the reality of Earth's physical constraints of peak oil, peak water, peak soil, etc.?
We have this artificially induced huge population bulge that's created by fossil fuels and in particular the ability to produce chemical fertilizers at a scale we've never done before. So that allows lots of food to be made and lots of babies to be born because of that. So part of it is simply the natural decline of the human population that is liable, not certain because you can't predict the future, but it's liable to happen. But also, I think if we look at models of how cities have behaved over the last 2,000 years, that most cities were supplied by the areas around them, and it was a fairly small footprint that the anachronistic license plate of the state of New Jersey is Garden State, and everybody wonders, you know, well, that doesn't seem like New Jersey, but it used to be the truck gardens of New Jersey and Connecticut and rural New York that supplied New York City with all their food. So cities traditionally have been supplied by the farmland immediately around them, and that wasn't that big of a footprint. So part of the story is allowing those wilder areas that are now being farmed but that won't be with a reduction in population to be restored or to return. And part of it is to look at the way natural systems produce food. You, I think, hit the nail on the head when you talked about food as a byproduct of a healthy ecosystem, that there are ways to tweak natural systems to produce more foods for people while still retaining habitat and the water cleaning and air cleaning abilities and all the other wonderful services the ecosystems provide for humans and the rest of nature. We can preserve that. And if you look at how indigenous people maintained land on large scales, the Mississippi River Valley, the Ohio, the Sacramento, all of these huge river valleys in North America were food forests when the European settlers arrived. They were tended and they were lightly managed, but they were incredibly productive food forests dominated by nut and fruit trees. The eastern hardwood forests were dominated by chestnuts and white oaks, which are two principal foods, with lots of walnuts, hickory nuts, cherries, crab apples, all kinds of other trees. And when the tenders of those forests were exterminated, that was the end of those food forests as well, because the people who took care of them were no longer there. So there are really good models out there for immensely food productive areas that also retain habitat. So that's one of the ways, just in terms of food, that we should be doing a much better job, is to stop envisioning food as coming from farms and thinking of it more as, at the worst, coming from gardens, and at the best, coming from essentially natural ecosystems that we just tweaked a little bit to help feed us.
Food has long been seen as a mechanism of control, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on the tyranny of the biotech industry that is poisoning food and soil, and the Food Safety Modernization Act of 2012 that tightens the noose on small-scale organics, and any other obstacles you see to a real permaculture-friendly world.
Well, having worked as a geneticist for a number of years, I'm pretty intimately familiar with the rationale behind genetically modified crops. I worked in medical biotech rather than agricultural. But these products are simply coming from a profit motive. They really don't serve any purpose other than that. There is plenty of food out to feed everyone. The estimates are that there's enough food being produced to feed between 9 and 11 billion people. So this argument that we must have GMOs in order to feed humanity is really completely specious, and it's just a way of guilt-tripping people. So the natural abundance model just says we don't need to be taking these sorts of heroic measures in order to feed people. We live in a system that's really run by large corporations for large corporations, and if we try to play that game, we're not going to win. It's extremely difficult to fight. Even something like to get a GM labeling law is proving to be pretty much impossible, something that you would think would be as simple and as desired by people as that. I think we have to do more of an Aikido kind of move, step around on what's being done and simply grow food in the way that we think are best. And again, this is where local comes in to be the answer. There's been, you know, this argument about is local better or is organic better? And I think that that's not really the issue. It is simply how can we create healthy and vibrant food systems in the places that we live by supporting local farms, by just having direct contact with the people that are providing our food. As long as we have a huge chain of corporate intermediaries in between us and our food system, we're going to be on the losing end of that. I know the CSA that we belong to, for example, is not organically certified, but they use organic techniques, and even more, they go beyond organic. That's kind of the end run that a lot of people are using, is just going ahead and saying, well, we're going to grow healthy food and we're going to sell it to our local customers and to our friends and to the people in the area, and really kind of ignore or get out of the way of, just not put themselves in the path of this legislation. It's find ways to not be affected by it. It's not so much fighting, it's just stepping aside and letting that energy go by without it affecting them. That's one strategy. Really more of a guerrilla strategy. You don't confront the people that you're fighting directly. You step out of the way so that their energy doesn't affect you as much. And part of that is simply by growing healthy food and selling it to the local people around you and creating a network, creating a community. It's really all about those local networks and communities and sidestepping the larger corporate entities and the state.
You wrote that a modern society that has become severed from nature becomes insane. And with the large corporations controlling the food system and, you know, everything being controlled so severely, one thing that really rings true to me is this idea of freedom and how, as migratory hunter-gatherers, humans had culture, music and tools like you had mentioned, and art, but they weren't tied to this arduous, backbreaking work of farming, and they didn't have the surplus to worry about, protect, divvy out in unfair ways. And considering that it might be impossible by this time to go back to hunter-gatherers, do you see permaculture as being the middle ground, or what we could do now as getting back to that freer
right,
way of
right.
life?
Right, right. I mean, the freedoms that we have lost are just enormous. I mean, I, never having been born free, I don't think I can even conceive of what it was truly like to be a hunter-gatherer or to be even a more free type of human being of any form. But I look at permaculture as one way of helping to make that transition one step at a time. I mean, it'd be wonderful if we could just leap back to some supposedly ideal state, but that's not going to happen. We have to start where we are right now. And what permaculture offers, I think, is this toolkit, this way of focusing on a goal. And if that goal is to become a more free human being or a wilder human being or an even slightly less domesticated animal than the ones that we are, then permaculture really can help you figure out what the next step is. The wonderful thing is you don't have to do it all in one giant leap, that it's what the systems thinker Stuart Kaufman calls the next adjacent possible. It's what is next to you right now, what is one step away that will get you a little bit closer to your goal. You don't have to worry so much about what's 10 steps away or 100 steps away. You just make one step now, and that opens up a whole new range of possibilities that isn't open from where you are now. You take one step to a new place, suddenly a whole group of new possibilities open up, and one step at a time, you make it over to the place that you want to be. So that's what permaculture, I think, has to offer, is a toolkit and a roadmap for simply taking one little step and then the next little step. And after those, the rest of the steps will become much more apparent and much easier to you.
Not really even being able to know what that type of freedom would feel like. You know, I don't think it's something that a lot of people consider because we've been indoctrinated with the idea that we're free. And we have what seems like all these choices, whether, you know, it's Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or Dr. Pepper, or whatever. We think we have a lot of choices in this life. And in America, we do relatively, but it's such a eye-opening way of seeing our evolution. And I feel like a next extremely important step in our evolution of repair and resolution and taking care of the earth in order for it to take care of us and so on is ecological restoration. And I'm wondering how permaculture can inform and dovetail with larger scale ecological restoration projects.
Right. The challenge with large restoration projects is to really understand what it is we're restoring to, because conditions have usually been changed so much that even if 50 years ago or 100 years ago there was some natural ecosystem in that place, some supposedly untouched ecosystem, the conditions are different now. There's probably higher temperatures and less water and more polluted air, and the soil's been washed away. And so if we try to restore to what something was before, that might not even be doable anymore. The conditions may be so different that the plants that grew there, the animals that lived there 100 years ago, can't even survive in today's conditions. So one of the things that permaculture tries to offer is what really is going on at the site, and again, what would be the next steps to take to bring it toward whatever the goal is. And often the goal may not be bring back the chestnut tree or something like that. It would be a broader goal of how do we restore the natural processes of soil fertility building? How do we restore the insect habitat that was there before? Kind of really creating the conditions for nature to then take over rather than dictate what nature is supposed to be doing by, you know, removing the so-called weeds and planting the thing that we think should be there. That's a pattern of restoration. It's really falling apart now. We're really seeing the flaws in thinking we know what should be there and then putting it there and trying to make it be there, as opposed to creating conditions where nature can now allow certain plants to move in, certain animals to move in, because the conditions have been restored or fertility has been restored or humidity has been raised just enough by creating some tree cover or something like that. We're really trying to let nature take over from us rather than our being the ones to guide the whole process. We don't know enough, and nature's had billions of years to figure out these things, but she's way better at restoration than we are. We just need to give her a chance.
And how does that tie into the native versus invasive species argument?
Well, a lot of ecologists and biologists who study invasive species are starting to understand that. Again, it's this idea that we don't really know what's going on, but when a so-called invasive species like say, purple loosestrife move into a wetland and suddenly all you see is purple loosestrife all over, we think of that as a disaster from our point of view. And when people start studying it, what they've learned about purple loosestrife is it supports just as many, if not more, native pollinators than the vegetation that it replaced. So it's not reducing pollinator diversity, and it may even be helping it. And another thing that purple loosestrife is doing is it's very tolerant of polluted water, whereas the native plants that it supposedly drove out were intolerant, so they weren't doing very well. So many of these so-called invasive species are a symptom of a problem. And if we correct the underlying problem, like clean up the water, then purple loosestrife will go away because it's not needed for that job anymore. So permaculture, I think, helps offers us some tools to reduce the kind of heat of that controversy by, again, reducing our footprint so that we can allow other areas outside of our footprint to truly return to the wild, and even allow the places inside our footprint to behave a little bit wilder as well by mixing exotic species that we use, since most of our food comes from exotic species, along with native species and other really functionally helpful species that can help bring natural processes back into being.
It's good to remember that a lot of time what we call invasive species are the plants that can live in a disturbed area, that build the soil and help with soil erosion, and the pioneer plants allow other plants to grow afterwards. It's good to be active and also realize that, like you said, nature has had billions of years to figure out how to restore and how to do these things. So to aid her in her own recovery rather than trying to be the dominant figures in that situation. I hear you have another book in the works about urban permaculture, and you mentioned recently the idea of tearing up every other street in a city and planting a food forest, which is pretty amazing to think about. Are there any teasers that you can divulge about your upcoming book?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I do have a book that I am just about to turn into the publisher in just a few weeks on urban permaculture. And one of the kind of surprises, in hindsight it's not so surprising, that I found in writing the book was that although there are several chapters on food growing in urban areas, it turned out that food was really not the most important thing to be thinking about in the city. That it's the major feature of the ecosystem in any city is the human beings, and the biggest resource in any city is the people. So the book has ended up focusing a lot more on developing community, finding sustainable and regenerative and healthy ways of earning a livelihood or creating livelihood in cities, justice, a lot of issues like that. How do we work with the issues that arise between human beings when we're all living together in a fairly small space? So the book it's really kind of one of the first permaculture books to start to go into the social side of permaculture rather than the food side of permaculture. So people are expecting only high-intensity food-growing methods for urban dwellers in apartments or something are going to find that it's a very different book from that, although I still do go into food a fair amount. But it's a much broader look at all the tools that permaculture can bring to urban living.
Do you know when that would be released or
well,
around about
if
time?
Everything goes smoothly, I'm hoping that it will be out about next March. That's certainly at the latest next summer.
Wonderful. Well, I will be looking out and our listeners will be looking for that, hitting the bookshelves. And to complete our conversation, is there anything that you'd like to share or mention?
Well, I think that last piece really is what I'm working on these days and what I think many people are discovering in permaculture, that is what you can learn from observing natural systems in terms of growing food and farming and more sustainable ways of agriculture and horticulture, all the things that nature has to teach us about growing food. It turns out that once you learn nature's principles for food production, they are completely applicable to developing energy sources, to improving water systems, and also to what we call in permaculture the invisible structures, so things like culture and justice and livelihood and security and community and all of those things. But the permaculture offers a really wonderful toolkit for a lot more than just food. And that, to me, is the really exciting part of permaculture, is growing into these new areas of the human side, the social and economic and political and even legal side of permaculture. It's how can we create really vibrant human communities at the same time that we're creating these vibrant natural communities that they're embedded into. So that's what's gotten me really excited these days.
Wow, definitely. Well, the food is definitely dependent upon a thriving ecosystem, a thriving human ecosystem as well, that once that's in place, other things can just thrive naturally. And we need a lot of guidance and work around our social structures and getting back to a collaborative community. And are there any tours that you have coming up or places where people can be involved in workshops?
Yeah, I live in Northern California, north of San Francisco, and I am regularly associated with a place called the Permaculture Skills Center. That's its website as well, permacultureskillscenter.com. And we have lots of workshops, lots of courses there. It's a beautiful 5-acre site that we're doing all kinds of projects, both plant and human related on. So that's where we have a lot of things going on. And I also teach courses in the Bay Area. And I also go wherever I'm invited. I do travel a lot and do workshops in many places. I'll be in Minneapolis at the end of this month doing a 2-day workshop on patterns, which is, there's information on that on my website and various other things. So my website's a good place to start. And Permaculture Skills Center here in Sebastopol is a good place to find me a fair amount of the time.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us about, the evolution of humans and where we can go from here. It's been a really awe-inspiring talk.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you all for listening to Unlearn and Rewild. And I'd also like to thank our producer, March Young. Our music selections today were Green Garden by Laura Mvula and Freedom from Rising Appalachia. Our theme song is, of course, by the late and great Kate Wolfe.
Drifting on the wind through the mountains like a river. Sweet smell of pine, tall western cedar. Drifting on.